Welcome back to a special edition of the show for this week. I'm your host, Mark Call, and I'm recording most of this on the 4th of July. And it should be better known as Independence Day, or better still, the day on which the Declaration of Independence was signed by those founders who pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors to a set of principles embodied in a document that has not only been largely forgotten, especially by the so-called educational system, but is in fact outright despised by far too many who sadly call themselves Americans. I'm going to say something controversial right up front today, folks. I believe if you do not hold those self-evident truths without which unanimously agreed there would be no United States of America, and that furthermore are the literal foundation upon which all subsequent law in this country, and by that I mean real law as opposed to the pretend kind, is based, you're not a real American. Oh, gee. Yes, he really said it. Because it's true, folks. And historically, it was not only true, but understood, up until the time when the law became not worth the parchment it was printed on, as George Bush famously pointed out. So I struggled a bit, this year particularly, with how to begin this discussion about what's really important concerning this day and the Declaration of Independence. In years past, I've concentrated on urging people to read it, study it, and understand it. And while that's still true and very important, there's a whole different level of outright animosity that I'm sure most of you have probably observed. It puts this day now in a very different light. Case in point, the sentiment expressed in a July 4th piece by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Treasury Secretary, entitled Liberty Has Lost Its Protection. And he summarizes it in the subheading by noting that July 4th now should be a day of mourning, because the rights our ancestors fought, and of course at least once famously pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors for, have been taken away. And he begins by talking about how over the course of his lifetime, which is true for most of us, there's been a fundamental shift in the attitude of the judiciary toward constitutional rights. Because basically there was a time when they would guard against any diminishing of constitutional rights, and that was more important even than getting a conviction. Now, they don't give a flying you-know-what about constitutional rights, period. Honestly, to the point where the very worst abuses outlined in those grievances by the colonists against the evil, despotic, tyrannical King George III of Great Britain are practically trivial in comparison. King George had general warrants. New York City has stop and frisk. While TSA has searching and groping at airports, the likes of which the Redcoats wouldn't have even dreamed of, much less dared to commit. And let's not kid ourselves, if the evil King George III had had Google and two Facebook, we'd probably still be subjects of the British Crown today. And note that they still don't have free speech over there. Dr. Roberts points to examples of usurpations against the rule of law dating back years at this point. The war on crime, the war on, well, at least some drugs, the war on, well, at least some child abuse, the war on, well, at least some terror. All have destroyed the U.S. Constitution by what he called the death of a thousand cuts. And let's not forget selective enforcement. And if all of that fails, folks, you can simply bring in hundreds of thousands or millions of people who couldn't care less about the rule of law. Witness the fact that they're willing to break it by coming in. Why? Because basically the lure is a whole bunch of free stuff, all of which is totally anathema to the principles that we once held to be self-evident to begin with. Dr. Roberts concludes that the America romanticized by the various 4th of July fireworks celebrations no longer exists. And at least on that score, he's clearly correct. The Rutherford Institute's primary freedom and liberty author and advocate, John W. Whitehead, wrote along the same line, saying, indeed, it's painfully fitting that mere days before the nation prepared to celebrate its freedoms on the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the City Council of Charlottesville, Virginia, home of Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration, voted to do away with a holiday in honor of his birthday, because Jefferson, like many of his contemporaries, owned slaves. And all of this in their total ignorance of what the man actually wrote, stood for, and fought for. Maybe, however, they're even less without excuse than the University of Virginia, founded by Thomas Jefferson, which is not only equally ignorant and perhaps even more politically correct, but actually commits the crime of dumbing down the students, sick, who now go there, mistakenly believing they were going to get an education. Says Whitehead, this is what we've been reduced to. bureaucrats dithering over meaningless trivialities while the government goose steps all over our freedoms, and the nation is destroyed, by the way, from within and from without. Too often, he continues, we pay lip service to those freedoms, yet they didn't come about by happenstance. They were won through sheer determination, suffering, and sacrifice by thousands of patriotic Americans who believed not only in the cause of freedom, but also had the intestinal fortitude to act on that belief. The success of the American Revolution for Independence, he notes, owes much to these men and women. And this is an interesting quote. See if you can follow the logic here. In standing up to the British Empire and speaking out against an oppressive regime, they exemplified courage in the face of what seemed like an overwhelming foe. At that point, probably the most powerful army the world had ever seen. Indeed, he says, imagine living in a country where armed soldiers crash through doors to arrest and imprison citizens for merely criticizing government officials. Imagine that in this very same country, you're watched, listened to, monitored all the time. And if you even look a little bit suspicious, the police stop and frisk you or pull you over to search you on the off chance you're doing something, anything, illegal. And keep in mind that if you have a firearm of any kind or something that even looks like a firearm, it may get you arrested or in some cases shot by police. And he says, if you're thinking this sounds like America today, you wouldn't be far wrong. But that is, in fact, the way the scenario that took place well over 200 years ago was described, when American colonists suffered under Great Britain's version of an early police state. And it was only when the colonists finally got fed up with being silenced, censored, searched, frisked, threatened, and arrested that they finally revolted against the tyrant's fetters. And, of course, no document better states those grievances than the Declaration of Independence, drafted by Thomas Jefferson. The 56 men who 243 years ago laid it all on the line in support of that document believed in a radical idea that people are created to be free. And labeled traitors, they were charged with treason, a crime punishable by death. For some, their acts of rebellion would cost them their homes and their fortunes. For others, it would be the ultimate price, their lives. And yet, these men dared to speak up when silence was intolerable. Imagine, though, the shock and the outrage those same 56 men would feel today were they to discover that the government they once risked their lives to create has been transformed into a militaristic police state in which even exercising one's freedoms, the things they ensconced in the Bill of Rights, or even in some cases just questioning a government agent, is not only viewed as a flagrant act of defiance, but criminalized. He suggests that we need to renew that determination and remember what the Declaration says. That the point of government is to secure the God-given rights of its people, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. That, in other words, we could use some of that revolutionary outrage today. As for your host, I want to make one other additional observation at this point. It seems that the left coast is shocked, shocked, I tell you, at least Hollywood is, that the president would actually bring tanks to Washington, D.C. to celebrate, well, arguably not the Declaration of Independence, perhaps America's military prowess, at least as it's projected overseas. But I can't help but think that, as usual, they're getting upset over the entirely wrong thing. Kind of like Nike seems to. They got no problem kowtowing to the communist Chinese, but they hate anything that even smells like an American symbol, especially, I guess, the Betsy Ross flag showing the 13 original colonies that became those first 13 states. But all of that seems to make the point, folks. None of the argument here is about the fact that the United States has completely turned its back on the principles that once formed the basis for everything else that made America what it is. They claim to be anti-fascist while advocating for it. They claim to be anti-slavery while instituting it on more levels and in more ways than most dumbed-down Americans even have a clue about. And they're really upset about tanks in Washington, D.C. They ought to be upset because the tanks aren't on the border defending the United States from the invasion coming up from the south. Or at least on the Nevada border facing California. Which kind of takes me full circle to the place that I started today. Should this date mark a celebration for what we once knew and had while we knew it? Or should it mark a day of mourning for what we've deliberately allowed to fall into not just disrepair, but disrepute? I can't help but think back to Ben Franklin's response to the woman who asked him outside the Constitutional Convention, "What form of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin?" To which he replied, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. And I guarantee you, folks, most Americans today wouldn't even know what form of government they were once supposed to have. And no, it was never a democracy. And anybody who's ever read any of those documents will know you don't find that word in any form in any of the original documents, from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Because as they pointed out in many of their other writings, democracy, they knew, would result in precisely the kind of tyranny they were seeking to guard against reoccurring on these shores. Which brings me to one more really important observation having to do with law and the founding of a nation that's pretty well been deep-sixed at this point, both by enemies from within and from without. Especially if you remember that democracy is a form of government where 51% can completely steal and destroy the life, liberty, and property of the other 49%, and have, and will, by majority vote. Want to take somebody's stuff? Just outvote them. Want to steal their children? Well, once you take away their firearms. Want to kill them? Just outvote them. The Electoral College was just one of many impediments put in the Constitution to defend against the evils of democracy. Like two senators from each state, it was all about protecting the rights of the smaller, less populous states against the big and now obviously socialist ones that would otherwise run roughshod over them, and certainly intend to. Witness what we're seeing with this direct democracy popular vote initiative signed by a whole bunch of really big socialist states. One by one, folks, we're seeing all the barriers that the founders wisely put in place to prevent democracies, which Madison noted have short lives and violent deaths, from infesting America. And let's not forget that if invasion from within doesn't work fast enough, there's always invasion from without. Why not open the borders, offer people all kinds of wonderful incentives to come on in and destroy the form of government we've had, which they didn't even know about or care about anyway, and replace it with mob rule? There's a reason, folks, why the continuing and massive invasion from the South is such a huge, divisive, and yes, downright deadly issue. First, economically and philosophically, and then, of course, inevitably, physically. Which leads me to do a bit of compare and contrast on this particular day. You could call it a logical argument if you want, or even philosophical, because the founders fought a war of independence for less than we're seeing on a number of fronts today. From those usurpations we've talked about, to the outright invasion. I can remember former President George W. Bush using this line more than once, saying, "We're taking the fight to the terrorists abroad so that we don't have to face them here at home." And gee, folks, some of us once thought that's what borders were about. Come to think of it, it's why we lock our doors. Knowing, of course, that the really, really bad guys will just pick the locks or bust the door down completely. And we're seeing that at large now. And that's, of course, why free people still understand the value of defensive weaponry. But it occurred to me that as a pilot, I have kind of a special reaction to all of this. I've shared certain aspects of it before, but I think in the context of dealing with immigration, especially the illegal and terrorist-filled kind, it's important to take a look at that again today. Most of you regular listeners know that I'm a private pilot. I've been a private pilot literally for decades, and I've owned a Cessna 182, a.k.a. a Skylane, for almost as long. And one of the things that I've had the joyful privilege of doing is flying that airplane just about all over North America, from way up north in Canada to way out east in the Bahamas, and several times down to Costa Rica, and lots of wonderful places in between. One of my favorite vacation destinations, and I guess this dates me, was the Baja, back before what's happened since happened. The entire peninsula was dotted with literally scores of airports, many of them associated with hotels that liked to cater to private pilots as a result. Many others were in small little towns where the locals understood the value of touristas dropping in to visit, enjoy a meal, or spend the night. And there were a whole lot of airstrips literally right on the beach where you could drop in to go snorkeling or fishing or windsurfing. But long before even 9/11, I noticed things beginning to change radically. And I wasn't alone in noticing that. Almost every pilot who ever flew from California or Arizona through customs and down to the Baja had the same observations. Somebody or something seemed to be working hard to try to destroy the businesses, the industry, the ability of private pilots to fly down south. And over time, not only were the vast majority of those airports shut down, many of them were even ditched. And in some cases, it was done by the USDEA in a foreign country over the objections of the owners. Well, you may be thinking, and this, of course, is precisely what the propagandists want us to all think, it's all about drugs, and people were using those airstrips to bring drugs into the United States. Never mind that it really wasn't that efficient, especially in smaller planes that couldn't carry nearly as much as, say, a tractor-trailer rig or a whole bunch of cars streaming across the border, or even teams of coyotes. And just maybe, by now you're seeing where I'm headed, but after making a vacation trip to the Baja every year or two for well over a decade, it was my first trip to Central America that really opened my eyes. And yeah, folks, that was definitely a major adventure. I planned it out for months in advance, got information. In those days, before the internet, you had to deal with foreign consulates to get entry permissions and visas in advance to some countries, like Honduras and Belize. By the same token, there were some countries, like El Salvador and Nicaragua, that I was reluctant to fly over, so we went offshore. But still, it was a wonderful and exciting trip, and I learned a whole lot. Now, as a scuba diver, one of the things that I really wanted to do was dive the world's second-largest barrier reef off the shore of Belize. There's also a big tourist attraction in those islands in that vicinity called the Blue Hole. And we arranged in advance a several-day excursion aboard a liveaboard dive boat. And it turned out on just about every front to be one of the best dive trips I've ever made. But the flying part of the story goes like this. The owner of the dive shop said, hey, look, it's a 6-hour trip across some pretty rough ocean out to the place where we're going to be doing all the diving, but there is a private airstrip out there on one of those islands that's got a nice little resort on it. Normally it's hard to get permission, but we've arranged that for you, and you're welcome to fly out and meet the boat there. It'll save you some time besides. And I thought, that's a great idea, and of course, as a private pilot, I love landing at new, interesting places. And that gave all of us a good chance to see the barrier reef from the air, too, so it was a win-win all the way around. So when we got out to that nice paved strip on the beautiful tropical island, I set up to land, and as I was literally on short final, I thought, hey, what is that on the runway? It was a whole bunch of orange 55-gallon drums, or barrels. So I aborted the landing, went around, and then immediately noticed all kinds of people running like little ants onto the field and rolling those barrels off. So we came back around and landed, and the manager of the resort came out to meet us right as we shut down the engines and apologized, which resulted in a really interesting discussion. The USDEA, he told me, and I thought, what? The USDEA in Belize? Well over 1,000 miles from the nearest U.S. border or possession? Yeah, that DEA keeps trying to shut down our airstrip, he says, and that would basically destroy our business. So at least for now, they're going to let us keep our airstrip as long as we leave 55-gallon barrels all over it, except when we're notified in advance that somebody's coming in to land. And again, he said, sorry about today. That way, evidently, if any pilot ever needed it in the case of an emergency, it would destroy the airplane. The bottom line all of us agreed, then and now, was that this was an incredible overreach, way out of U.S. jurisdiction, and it really did seem to have more to do with shutting down general aviation than it did with stopping drug trafficking. Especially when you think about it, if that same government is more than willing to leave the U.S. borders wide open. And in later trips to Costa Rica, folks, I saw example after example after example. And eventually it got to the point where I often talked with government and airport officials, often in Spanish with those that didn't speak English. Occasionally I asked some pretty pointed questions and got some pretty interesting answers. But one phrase that I heard over and over again was, Es su gobierno, señor. In other words, it's your government that's making us do these things we don't want to do. And in lots and lots of cases, it was literally cutting their economic throats. To the point where, the last time I was in Costa Rica, that's been a number of years ago, at a coastal airport called Liberia in Guanacaste, my single-engine Cessna was the only plane on the ramp that wasn't a corporate biz jet. And yes, Big Brother has now made it so hard and so dangerous, I don't want to go back, and I haven't. And one more really important aviation-related observation before I get to the coup de grace. Several times en route south, I flew over the Yucatan Peninsula. There's a really neat airport at an archaeological site you may have heard of called Chichen Itza en route. That used to be a really interesting place to land to go see the museum and Aztec pyramids and so forth. And from there south towards Belize and the Caribbean, you're flying over some of the most incredible and dense jungle on planet Earth. My father, who used to ferry airplanes all over the world for a living, starting before I was born, once told me that of all the places he's ever flown and didn't want to have an engine failure, A jungle like that was far and away at the top of the list, because basically, without a place to land, your plane would never even get through the canopy of trees to the ground. But thankfully, at least once upon a time, that wasn't an issue for pilots that wanted to fly safely to Central and South America, because there was a beautiful, wide, four-lane highway, the Pan American, that you could follow all the way down, knowing full well that if there ever was a problem, plenty of places to land, right below you, anywhere. Well, that is, before Big Brother decided, we want to preclude that option, and if it kills a few folks, hey, no problem. Because somebody's tax dollars at work evidently paid for a whole bunch of poles to be set up along that entire beautiful strip of emergency runway so that it would destroy any airplane that even thought about trying to land there. But evidently the same folks don't want to allow any money to be spent to build a wall. And throughout this entire set of stories, folks, what I'm trying to demonstrate to you is why so many pilots, having seen firsthand the hypocrisy of, uh-oh, we're going to shut you down, we're going to shut down all the businesses that thrive and survive doing things related to aviation and people being able to have the freedom of flight, even over international borders, all the while, on the other hand, lying through their teeth about how we've got to stop drug trafficking at any cost, and it's all about safety, unless, of course, we're talking about pilots and maybe kids that would be in the planes with them. We don't care if they die. We want to encourage mothers to drag their children through rivers or across barren deserts and see if they die that way. So literally, folks, for decades, I've seen the talk out of both sides of your mouth BS coming from people that tell us we've got to stop drug trafficking and all kinds of bad things entering the border, well, at least by air, but we could care less if people bring disease, drugs, and sex slaves across by land. Is there a disconnect here somewhere? But the final straw for me was a bit of Big Brother intimidation called EAPIS, the Electronic Advanced Pilot Information System, which went online about the time I made my last voluntary trip out of the formerly free United States by private airplane. Now, folks, over the years, I've seen the border crossing procedures get more and more and more bureaucratic, downright tyrannical, and, of course, expensive. That is, if you play by the rules and don't try to enter what you thought was your own country illegally. What really was the final straw about EAPIS, however, was that for the first time in American history, pilots actually had to ask in advance for permission to leave the country. And if that sounds a bit like Nazi Germany or the Iron Curtain, we're probably on the same page. And yes, there are no shortage of pilots with lots of really interesting and downright terrifying stories about the police state on that score. And as many of you probably know or at least suspect, if you cross the border by air without permission in advance, there's at least a fair chance, or so they'll tell you, that you might very well get shot down. So I guess if you're going to enter en masse, bringing disease, drugs, weapons that free Americans are no longer allowed to possess, and of course sex slaves too, clearly there's one major option. Come across by the tens or hundreds of thousands via the unprotected entire southern U.S. border. And not only will they not take your plane apart on the ramp, fine you all kinds of bucks, they'll give you free stuff and bus tickets too. Or maybe air travel, so that you can spread whatever it is you just brought in all over the country. And that, folks, in a nutshell, is why so many pilots, including your host, are more than disgusted with the incredible, not just hypocrisy, but stupidity of protecting the border against people that we don't need protection from, while inviting and literally subsidizing hundreds of thousands or millions of potential terrorists to come on in mass. And we'll pay you to boot. So any way you slice it, please understand this. The reasons you've been given for what's really going on at the southern border are 101% bald-faced lies, any and every way you look at them. Please think about that on this 4th of July, as some of us at least remember what it was that Americans, real Americans, as opposed to those that now sit in Congress and run for president, pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to build. And it's now being invaded and destroyed. Over the brain, you better wake up before it's too late. Get ready to rumble, put all the God's armor on. We're killing our babies before they are born. Stand up and be kind and come and sound the alarm. Are you one of God's children, or nothing but the devil's hound? Welcome back to this special edition of the show for today. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and this is, of course, a special show commemorating the signing of the Declaration of Independence. This seems like a particularly good year for that, or bad year if you've thought about what the founders were actually fighting for, and yes, especially against. And I really don't have time, or for that matter, even the inclination at this point, to talk about all of the things that the founders would have listed as grievances, probably ahead of some of those that made their cut. But as we've already discussed, a whole lot of what they were angry about should sound painfully familiar. But what I want to do today is focus on the really important elements of that legal document. It's an indictment, actually. It became the Declaration of Independence and was unanimously signed, almost miraculously even, by representatives of all of the original colonies who put their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor on the line in the process. So let's go through it now, and I'll comment on the things as we do that, rest assured, you won't see taught in the public cesspools or hear quoted, in context anyway, in the halls of Congress or even the White House. It starts out with what you might call the why paragraph, why it's necessary for the founders to do what they did, and it goes like this. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And right off the top, we've got two important notes in there. Not only the mention of natural law, which basically deals with the whole issue of where our rights come from and why government is supposed to protect them, which will be explored in the next paragraph, but also the first of four references to the Creator, God Almighty, and the author of Scripture that will appear in the rest of the document. We'll see the central one, God the Creator, in the next paragraph. All that reference to laws is the first of three that come directly out of Isaiah chapter 33, which outline three specific governmental attributes and form the basis for the idea of separation of powers. Isaiah 33:22 says, "For Yahuwah is our judge, Yahuwah is our lawgiver, Yahuwah is our king. He will save us." And even that last word in the verse in the original Hebrew is a direct reference to the Savior himself, whose very name means the salvation of Yah. But there in that one verse, we see that the God of the universe is our judge, our lawgiver, and our king. And as James Madison later observed in the time frame of the Constitutional Convention, we can't trust those three powers to be combined in the hands of any single or groups of fallen men, but rather in his hands only. Thus, the foundation for the separation of powers, executive, legislative, and judicial. We've seen the reference now to the legislative branch. The other two references will be obvious as we get to them. But first, this paragraph that your host will suggest is not only the foundation for all law in the formerly free republics, and why I put it that way will be obvious too, but arguably the most important paragraph ever written originally in the English language. It lays out the foundation for everything that follows in the Declaration of Independence, and indeed, the entire structure and purpose of government itself. And it lays out and builds upon what I will contend is the foundation of the essence of what it means to be an American. We start here, and everything else follows. We fail to build upon this rock, and the entire edifice, as we've already been seeing, crumbles. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And I'll pause there and talk about some of the specifics, because as they so clearly understood, if we can't agree on that, and they did, unanimously, nothing else matters. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," it begins. In other words, in geometry, we're talking about what would be called a postulate. Any proofs that follow are based on it. In legal parlance, it's called a maxim of law. Without that foundation to build on, there is no law. It goes on to talk about equality under the law, and to note that all of us are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. And that word is properly pronounced unalienable, and it means cannot be leaned, cannot be mortgaged, if you will, taken away by any government of mere men. If our rights come from God, then only He can take them away. Which leads to the next sentence as well, and we'll get to that in a minute. So, it's self-evident that we have a Creator, that our rights come from Him, and that among those rights, by the way, that means not limited to, are life, liberty, and property, which is foundational to the pursuit of happiness. In other words, if you don't own your own time, your own life, your own body, and have the right to the fruits of your labor, how are you going to pursue much of anything? The next sentence outlines the singular purpose of government, and it says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And here I'll pause with one simple note. What they're describing here is a withdrawal of consent for just cause, for reasons that they're going to outline in some detail as part of the indictment. And here comes the point, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. From here they go on to say, and they're not taking this matter lightly either, quote, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That's about as clear a statement as why what is necessary, backed up by what's coming next, as you'll ever see. Such, they continue, has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. It's blunt, it's direct, and oh, they continue to say, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And here next, folks, follows the list of all of that evidence, basically a chain of indictments. Things that the tyrannical government of the time had done. Starting with laws not passed, and continuing to things that really weren't laws and shouldn't have been done at all, but were anyway. Quote, he has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasion on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time, after such dissolutions, to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. And this next one almost sounds like the opposite of what we're seeing today, although it clearly follows on that issue of invasion from without and convulsions within. He's endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He's obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers, and he has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices with the amount and payment of their salaries. Today, that pendulum, too, has arguably hit the other stop. But these next few ought to really resonate, because if anything, what we're seeing writ large today in America with a K exceeds anything that the founders were so rightfully complaining about. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. And you know what, folks? If there's a single grievance that pretty well nails the entire set of unconstitutional putting all powers together in one single branch, executive, legislative, and judicial, in other words, tyrannies, in America today, that one pretty well nails it. He has sent hither swarms of bureaucrats to harass our people and eat out their substance. From TSA, NSA, FDA, DEA, DOA, EPA, FBI, IRS, and ATF, to just about any other TLA or three-letter acronym you can imagine, they're definitely harassing our people, not to mention searching, tapping, and groping them, and eating our substance. And far, far, far too many of them, from IRS to Fish and Wildlife, are armed as well, in ways that the American people are no longer allowed to be. And that bears directly on these next few. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislature. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. And when it comes to the complete destruction of the rule of law, folks, and the Constitution as a dead letter, listen to this. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. Today's examples? Obviously, gun control, warrantless searches and seizures, wiretaps, groping innocent people at airports, civil forfeiture, and yes, the entire unconstitutional concept of a crime by a free person of possession of something or anything. Remember, folks, it once took a constitutional amendment to prohibit alcohol. Why can they prohibit everything else now without even pretending to worry about the Constitution anymore? Well, we've seen plenty of examples of late of pretended legislation. The list that Jefferson and the founders came up with included the following: for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial. And here, if you think back to the assassinations at Ruby Ridge, the mass murders at Waco, and the cover-ups of all kinds of acts of false flag terrorism since, you can kind of see where they're headed. For protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases, and now we could say in all cases, folks, because we haven't had honest trial by jury as the Constitution intended and the common law outlined in this country for most of our lifetimes. But the original language still more than makes the point. For depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. Yep, like gun possession by a formerly free person. But they don't even have to send you to Guantanamo anymore to get away with that one. And this one's kind of interesting if you think about all the kind of ways that Big Brother's been getting around the law today that sound a lot like this. For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries, so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, First Amendment, Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, you know what I'm saying, and fundamentally altering the forms of our government. Yeah, I know. Anybody buying the democracy lie? We were never supposed to have had one. And this last one, folks, is outright damning. And I'll expand upon this one in just a second. for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Which they acknowledged, indirectly here and explicitly in other writings, was an absolute grant of total power, subject to literally no limitation. And some of you know where I'm going. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, actually provides for exactly that kind of unlimited power, but in one very, very specific and arguably tiny area. The 10-square-mile district, later known as D.C., whether you call it the District of Columbia or District of Criminals. What it says in Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 17, and note they use the exact same wording, is that Congress shall have the power to, quote, exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, unquote, over this district, not to exceed 10 miles square, that will become the seat of government. Which is particularly interesting in light of that grievance we just read, which referred to abolishing the free system of English laws in a particular place and then enlarging its boundaries so that they could do the same thing to provide absolute rule over the rest of these colonies. Get it? Big Brother's clever, tyrannical lawyers sure did, starting with the 14th Amendment and then really hitting their stride with FDR's New Deal. As I've talked about many times on the Come Out of Her My People show, that is precisely what Big Brother did in the case of the District of Criminals by declaring ultimately that everyone who doesn't understand any better and declares that they are a citizen of the United States, and perhaps not surprisingly, that language has a lot of definitions in a law dictionary, actually is domiciled in the District of Criminals, whether or not they reside in some other place, and therefore they are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Which means you've got civil liberties, but not many of them, and that's in lieu of those once God-given rights. Aren't they clever? And by the way, that's precisely why the likes of Patrick Henry and some of the other anti-federalists warned about what was being done, that it would lead exactly to the kind of tyranny we're seeing today, and at least convince the ratifiers of the Constitution to insist on a Bill of Rights that was at least intended to override that all cases whatsoever claim and prevent infringement of the right to keep and bear arms or the destruction of free speech and so forth. Obviously, in hindsight, it hasn't worked. Many of you who haven't yet succumbed to political correctness also realize that there was one grievance that Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin were forced to remove from the Declaration, having to do with what they literally called the execrable institution of slavery. Those who prefer to ignore the lessons of history and paint with a broad brush all of those, quote, dead white men who signed the document would prefer to ignore this, one of the most important and divisive battles fought during the entire process of ratifying the resolution for independence. But without this excision, there would have been no independence in the American colonies. What Jefferson originally wrote, though, was the following, at least in part, because this is the longest grievance in the whole document. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, he said, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain. Determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold, he has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. And he goes on to talk about this assemblage of horrors, but you get the picture. Even in this time, folks, there were compromises made, not only for the purposes of politics, but getting the bigger job done. As Franklin basically observed, we need to fight one battle at a time. Independence first, and they all knew that the battle against slavery, one way or another, would come later. The rest of the grievances went like this. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burned our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Which brings us to the conclusion, folks, where they lay out not only what all of this means, but what needs to be done about it. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince, whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. So there you have it. But there's one last, if you will, lament before we get to the conclusion and what must be done. And it takes the form of an appeal to the people of Britain rather than the tyrants that form the government. Nor have we been wanting, they say, in attention to our British brethren. We've warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We've reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and to consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. And here it comes, folks. We, therefore, the representatives of the United, and that's specifically spelled with a small u, because these are United, capital S, states. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world, did you catch it? For the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliance, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And here comes one of the other most famous lines in the document, and that final reference to God Almighty, who is in fact our King. You may recall at this point another famous line from the Revolutionary War era, no king but King Jesus. Quote, and for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Now, at this point, I note again, just historically speaking, that the unanimous vote to declare independence and accept the resolution was actually taken on July 2nd, and that was the day that John Adams thought would be celebrated in the future with fireworks. John Hancock famously signed it real big so King George could read it without his spectacles, but it wasn't until a couple days later that everybody else signed along with him. Today, we need to consider whether we'd be willing to do that and what that means.